This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Kind Worth Killing by Peter Swanson. This book is read by Johnny Heller, Karen White, Kathleen Early, and Keith Sarabica. For my mother, Elizabeth Ellis Swanson. Part 1. The Rules of Airport Bars.
Chapter 1. Ted. "Hello there," she said. I looked at the pale, freckled hand on the back of the empty bar seat next to me in the business-class lounge at Heathrow Airport, then up into the stranger's face. "Do I know you?" I asked. She didn't look particularly familiar, but her American accent, her crisp white shirt, her sculpted jeans, tucked into knee-high boots, all made her look like one of my wife's awful friends. "No, sorry. I was just admiring your drink. Do you mind?" She folded her long, slender frame onto the leather-padded swivel stool and set her purse on the bar. "Is that gin?" she asked about the martini in front of me. "Hendricks," I said. She gestured toward the bartender, a teenager with spiky hair and a shiny chin, and asked for a Hendricks martini with two olives. When her drink came, she raised it in my direction. I had one sip left and said, "Here's to inoculation against international travel." "I'll drink to that." I finished my drink and ordered another. She introduced herself, a name I instantly forgot, and I gave her mine. Just Ted, and not Ted Severson, at least not right then. We sat in the overly padded and overly lit Heathrow lounge, drinking our drinks, exchanging a few remarks, and confirming that we were both waiting to board the same direct flight to Logan Airport in Boston. She removed a slim paperback novel from her purse and began to read it. It gave me an opportunity to really look at her. She was beautiful. Long red hair, eyes a lucid greenish-blue like tropical waters, and skin so pale it was the almost bluish-white of skim milk. If a woman like that sits down next to you at your neighborhood bar and compliments your drink order, you think your life is about to change. But the rules are different in airport bars, where your fellow drinkers are about to hurtle away from you in opposite directions. And even though this woman was on her way toward Boston, I was still filled with sick rage at the situation with my wife back home. It was all I had been able to think about during my week in England. I'd barely eaten, barely slept. An announcement came over the loudspeaker, in which the two discernible words were Boston and delayed. I glanced at the board above the rows of backlit top-shelf liquor and watched as our departure time was moved back an hour. "Time for another," I said, "my treat." "Why not?" she said, and closed her book, placing it face up on the bar by her purse. "The Two Faces of January, by Patricia Highsmith." "How's your book?"
"Not one of her best."
"Nothing worse than a bad book and a long flight delay."
"What are you reading?" she asked.
"The newspaper. I don't really like books."
"So what do you do on flights?"
"Drink gin, plot murders."
"Interesting."
She smiled at me, the first I'd seen. It was a wide smile that caused a crease between her upper lip and nose, and that showed perfect teeth and a sliver of pink gums. I wondered how old she was. When she first sat down, I thought she was in her mid-30s, closer to my age. But her smile and the spray of faded freckles across the bridge of her nose made her look younger. 28, maybe. My wife's age. "And I work, of course, when I fly," I added.
"What do you do?"
I gave her the short story version, how I funded and advised internet startup companies. I didn't tell her how I'd made most of my money, by selling those companies off as soon as they looked promising. And I didn't tell her that I never really needed to work again in this lifetime, that I was one of the few dot-commers from the late 1990s that managed to pull up my stakes and cash out my stocks right before the bubble burst. I only hid these facts because I didn't feel like talking about them, not because I thought my new companion might find them offensive or lose interest in talking with me. I'd never felt the need to apologize for the money I'd made. "What about you? What do you do?" I asked.
"I work at Winslow College. I'm an archivist."
Winslow was a woman's college, in a leafy suburb about 20 miles west of Boston. I asked her what an archivist does, and she gave me what I suspect was her own short story version of her work. How she collected and preserved college documents.
Then you live in Winslow? I asked.
I do.
Married?
I'm not. You? Even as she said it, I caught the subtle flick of her eyes as she looked for a ring on my left hand.
Yes, unfortunately, I said.
Then I held up my hand for her to see my empty ring finger. And no, I don't remove my wedding ring in airport bars in case a woman like you sits down next to me. I've never had a ring. I can't stand the feel of them.
Why unfortunate? She asked.
It's a long story.
It's a flight delay.
You really want to hear about my sordid life?
How can I say no to that?
If I'm going to tell you, I'm going to need another one of these. I held up my empty glass.
You?
No, thank you. Two is my limit. She slid one of the olives off the toothpick with her teeth and bit down on it. I caught a brief glimpse of the pink tip of her tongue. I always say that two martinis are too many and three is not enough.
That's funny. Didn't James Thurber also say that?
Never heard of him, I said and smirked, although I felt a little sheepish, trying to pass off a famous quote as my own. The bartender was suddenly in front of me and I ordered another drink. The skin around my mouth had taken on that pleasurable, numb feeling one gets from gin, and I knew that I was in danger of being too drunk and saying too much. But it was airport rules, after all, and even though my fellow traveler lived only 20 miles from me, I had already forgotten her name, and knew there was very little chance of ever seeing her again in my lifetime. And it felt good to be talking and drinking with a stranger. Just speaking words out loud was causing some of my rage to dissipate. So I told her the story. I told her how my wife and I had been married for 3 years, and that we lived in Boston. I told her about the week in September at the Kennewick Inn along the south coast of Maine, and how we'd fallen in love with the area, and bought some ridiculously overpriced shorefront property. I told her how my wife, because she had a master's degree in something called arts and social action, decided she was qualified to co-design the house with an architecture firm, and had been spending the majority of her recent time in Kennewick, working with a contractor named Brad Daggett.
And she and Brad?
She asked after sliding the second olive into her mouth.
Uh-huh. Are you positive?
So I gave her more details. I told her how Miranda had been growing bored with our life in Boston. For the first year of our marriage, she had thrown herself into decorating our brownstone in the South End. After that, she had gotten a part-time job at a friend's gallery in the Soho District. But even then, I knew that things were getting stale. We had begun to run out of conversation midway through dinner, had started going to bed at different times. More importantly, we had lost the identities that had originally defined us in our relationship. In the beginning, I was the rich businessman who introduced her to expensive wine and charity galas, and she was the bohemian artist who booked trips to Thai beaches and liked to hang out in dive bars. I knew that we were our own kind of strained cliché, but it worked for us. We clicked on every level. I even enjoyed the fact that even though I consider myself handsome in a generic sort of way, no one was ever going to look at me while I was in her presence. She had long legs and large breasts, a heart-shaped face and full lips. Her hair was a dark brown that she always kept dyed black. It was deliberately styled to look tousled, as though she'd come straight from bed. Her skin was flawless, and she didn't need makeup, although she never left the house without applying black eyeliner. I'd watched men fixate on her in bars and restaurants. Maybe I was projecting, but the looks they cast her way were hungry and primal. They made me glad I didn't live in a time or place where men habitually carried weapons. Our trip to Kennewick, Maine had been spontaneous, a reaction to a complaint from Miranda that we hadn't spent time alone in over a year. We went the third week of September. The first few days were cloudless and warm, but on Wednesday of that week, a rainstorm swept down from Canada, trapping us in our suite. We only left to drink Allagash White and eat lobster in the inn's basement tavern. After the storm passed, the days turned cool and dry, the light grayer, the dusk longer. We bought sweaters and explored the mile-long cliff walk that began just north of the inn and wound its way beneath the swelling Atlantic and its rocky edge. The air, that had until recently been heavy with humidity and the smell of suntan lotion, was now crisp and briny. We both fell in love with Kennewick, so much so that when we found a piece of rose-hip-choked land for sale on a high bluff at the end of the path, I called the number on the for sale sign and made an immediate offer. 1 year later, the rosehip bushes had been cleared, a foundation dug, and the exterior of the 8-bedroom house was nearly complete. We'd hired Brad Daggett, a rugged divorcee with thick black hair, a goatee, and a bent-looking nose as our general contractor. While I spent my weeks in Boston, advising a group of recent MIT grads that had created a new algorithm for a blog-based search engine, Miranda was spending more and more time in Kennewick, taking a room at the inn, and surveying the work being done on the house, obsessing over every tile and every fixture. In early September, I decided to surprise her by driving up. I left a message on her cell phone as I got onto I-95 north of Boston. I arrived in Kennewick a little before noon and looked for her at the inn. They told me she'd been out since morning. I drove to the house site and parked behind Brad's F-150 on the gravel driveway. Miranda's robin's egg blue Mini Cooper was there as well. I hadn't visited the property for a few weeks and was happy to see that progress had been made. All the windows appeared to be in place, and the bluestone pavers that I had picked for the sunken garden had arrived. I walked around to the back of the house, where every second-floor bedroom had its own balcony, and where a screened-in veranda along the first floor led down to an enormous stone patio. In front of the patio, a rectangular hole had been dug for the pool. Walking up the stone steps of the patio, I spotted Brad and Miranda through the tall, ocean-facing kitchen windows. I was about to rap on the window to let them know I was there when something caused me to stop. They were each leaning against the newly installed quartz countertops, both looking out through the window with its view toward Kennewick Cove. Brad was smoking a cigarette, and I watched him flick an ash into the coffee cup he held in his other hand. But it was Miranda that had caused me to stop. There was something about her posture, the way she was leaning against the countertop, angled toward Brad's broad shoulders. She looked completely at ease. I watched her casually lift a hand as Brad slid the cigarette between her fingers. She took a long drag, then returned the cigarette to him. Neither had looked at the other during the exchange, and I knew then that not only were they sleeping together, but they were also probably in love. Instead of feeling anger or dismay, my immediate feeling was panic that they would spot me out on the patio, spying on their moment of intimacy. I backtracked toward the main entrance, crossed the veranda, then swung open the glass door and shouted hello into the echoey house. "In here," Miranda yelled back, and I walked into the kitchen. They had moved a little bit apart, but not by much. Brad was grinding out his cigarette in the coffee cup.
"Sandy, what a surprise," Miranda said.
She was the only one who called me that, a pet name that had started as a joke, since it did not fit me at all. "Hey, Ted," Brad said. "What do you think so far?" Miranda came around the counter and gave me a kiss that landed on the corner of my mouth. She smelled of her expensive shampoo and Marlboros. "It's looking good. My pavers arrived." Miranda laughed. "We let him pick one thing, and that's all he cares about." Brad came around the counter as well and shook my hand. His hand was large and knuckly, his palm warm and dry. "Want the full tour?" As Brad and Miranda took me around the house, Brad talking about building materials, and Miranda telling me what furniture would go where, I began to have second thoughts about what I had seen. Neither seemed particularly nervous around me. Maybe they had just become close friends, the type that stand shoulder to shoulder and share cigarettes. Miranda could be touchy-feely, linking arms with her girlfriends and kissing our male friends on the lips hello and goodbye. It occurred to me that there was a chance I was being paranoid. After the house tour, Miranda and I drove to the Kennewick Inn and had lunch in a livery tavern. We each got the blackened haddock sandwiches and I drank 2 scotch and sodas. "Has Brad got you smoking again?" I asked, wanting to catch her out in a lie, see how she would react. "What?" she said, her brow furrowing. "You smelled a little like smoke back at the house." "I might have snuck a jag or two. I'm not smoking again, Teddy." "I don't really care, I was just wondering."
"Can you believe the house is nearly done?"
she said as she dipped one of her French fries into my pool of ketchup. We talked about the house for a while, and I began to doubt what I had seen even more. She wasn't acting guilty.
"You staying for the weekend?" she asked.
"No, I just wanted to come up and say hi. I've got dinner tonight with Mark LaFrance."
"Cancel it and stay here. Weather's supposed to be beautiful tomorrow.
Mark flew in just for this meeting, and I need to prepare some numbers." I had originally planned on staying in Maine through the afternoon, hoping that Miranda would agree to a lengthy nap in her hotel room. But after seeing Brad and her canoodling in the very expensive kitchen that I was paying for, I changed my mind. I had a new plan. After lunch, I drove Miranda back to the house site so she could get her car. Then instead of driving directly to I-95, I got on a Route 1 and drove south to Kittery and its quarter-mile stretch of outlet stores. I pulled up to the Kittery Trading Post, an outdoor outfitter's that I'd driven past on numerous occasions but had never visited. In the space of about 15 minutes, I spent nearly $500 on a pair of rainproof camouflage print pants, a gray raincoat with a hood, some oversized aviator glasses, and a pair of high-end binoculars. I took the gear to a public restroom across from the Crate and Barrel outlet and changed into my new getup. With the hood up and the aviator glasses on, I felt unrecognizable, at least from a distance. I drove north again, parking in the public lot near the Kennewick Cove, squeezing my Quattro in between two pickup trucks. I knew there was no reason for Miranda or Brad to come down to this particular lot, but there was also no reason for me to make my car easy to spot. The wind had died down, but the sky was a low monochromatic gray, and a warm, misty rain had begun to pepper the air. I walked across the damp sand of the beach, then clambered over the loose rocks and shale that led to the start of the cliff walk. I moved carefully, keeping my eyes on the paved path, slick with rain and buckled in places by roots, instead of on the dramatic sweep of the Atlantic to my right. Some of the paved portions of the cliff walk had eroded away completely, and a faded sign warned walkers of its danger. Because of this, the path was not particularly well traveled, and I only saw one other person that afternoon, a teenage girl in a Bruins jersey that smelled as though she had just smoked a joint. We passed without saying anything or looking at one another. Toward the end of the path, I walked along the top of a crumbling cement wall that marked the back property line of a stone cottage, the last house before a quarter mile of undeveloped land that culminated in our lot. The path then dipped down to sea level, crossed a short rocky beach strewn with chewed-up buoys and seaweed, then continued along a steep rise through some twisted spruce trees. The rain had picked up, and I took off my wet sunglasses. The chance that either Miranda or Brad would be outside of the house was very slim, and my plan was to stop just short of the open sweep of cleared land and position myself in a copse of hardy shrubs along the low part of the bluff. If either looked out and saw me with my binoculars, they would assume I was a bird watcher. If I was approached, I could retreat quickly to the path. When I could see the house looming above the scarred land, it struck me, not for the first time, how the rear side, the side that faced the ocean, was stylistically opposite from the side that faced the road. The front of the house had a stone veneer with a smattering of small windows and a towering set of dark wood doors with exaggerated arches. The rear of the house was beige-painted wood, and all the identical windows with their identical balconies made it look like a medium-sized hotel. "I have a lot of friends," Miranda had said when I asked her why the house needed 7 guest bedrooms. Then she'd shot me a look as though I'd asked her why she thought indoor plumbing was necessary. I found a good spot under a stunted spruce that was bent and twisted like a bonsai tree. I lay down in the damp ground on my front and fiddled with the binoculars till I started to get the house in focus. I was about 50 yards away and could easily see through windows. I swept along the first floor, not spotting any movement, then worked my way across the second floor. Nothing. I took a break, surveying the house with my naked eye, wishing I had a view of the front driveway. For all I knew, there was nobody at the house at all, even though Daggett's truck had still been there when I dropped Miranda off. A few years earlier, I'd gone out fishing with a colleague, a fellow dot-com speculator who was the best open-water fisherman I'd ever known. He could stare out at the surface of the ocean and know exactly where the fish were. He told me that his trick was to unfocus his eyes, to take in everything in his visual range all at once, and by doing that, he could catch flickers of movement, disturbances in the water. I tried it at the time, and only succeeded in giving myself a dull headache. So after completing another sweep with my binoculars and seeing nothing, I decided to use this same trick on my own house. I let everything sort of blur in front of my eyes, waiting for any motion to draw attention to itself. And after I'd been staring at the house for less than a minute, I caught some movement through the high window of what was to be the living room on the north edge of the house. I lifted my binoculars and focused on the window. Brad and Miranda had just entered. I could see them pretty clearly. The lowering afternoon sun was hitting the window at a good angle, lighting up the interior without causing a glare. I watched Brad walk over to a makeshift table that had been set up by the carpentry crew. He picked up a piece of wood that looked like a section of ceiling molding and held it out for my wife to see. He ran a finger down one of its grooves, and she did the same thing. His lips were moving, and Miranda was nodding at whatever he was saying. For one brief moment, I felt ridiculous. A paranoid husband dressed up in camouflage and spying on his wife and his contractor. But after Brad put the molding down, I watched as Miranda slid into his arms, tilted her head back, and kissed him on the mouth. With one big hand, he reached down and pressed her hips against him, and with his other, he grabbed a handful of her unkempt hair. I told myself to stop watching, but somehow I couldn't. I watched for at least 10 minutes, watched as Brad bent my wife over the table, lifted her dark purple skirt, removed a pair of tiny white underpants, and entered her from behind. I watched Miranda position herself strategically along the table, one hand braced on its edge, the other between her own legs, guiding him inside of her. They had clearly done this before. I slid backward and into a sitting position. When I regained the path, I pulled my hood back and threw up my lunch into a dark, wind-ruffled puddle.
"How long ago was this?"
asked my fellow traveler after I'd told the story. "Just over a week." She blinked her eyes and bit at her lower lip. Her eyelids were pale as tissue paper.
"So what are you going to do about it?" she asked.
It was the question I'd been asking myself all week. What I really wanted to do was kill her. I smiled with my gin-numbed mouth and attempted a little wink, just to give her an opportunity to not believe me. But her face stayed serious. She lifted her reddish eyebrows.
"I think you should," she said,
and I waited for some indication that she was joking, but nothing came. Her stare was unwavering. Staring back, I realized that she was so much more beautiful than I had originally thought. It was an ethereal beauty, timeless, as though she were the subject of a Renaissance painting. So different from my wife, who looked like she belonged on the cover of a pulp novel from the 1950s. I was about to finally speak when she cocked her head to listen to the muffled loudspeaker. They'd just announced that they were boarding our flight.
Chapter 2. Lily. The summer I turned 14, my mother invited a painter named Chet to come and stay with us. I don't remember his last name, don't know, in fact, if I ever knew it. He came and stayed in the small apartment above my mother's studio. He had thick glasses in dark frames, a bushy beard that was always flecked with paint, and he smelled like overripe fruit. I remember the way his eyes darted down toward my chest when we were introduced. The summer was already hot, and I was wearing cut-off jeans and a tank top. My breasts were no bigger than mosquito bites, but he looked anyway. "Hi, Lily," he said. "Call me Uncle Chet." "Why? Are you my uncle?" He released my hand and laughed, a sputtering noise, like an engine dying. "Hey, I already feel like family here, the way your parents are treating me. A whole summer to paint, man? Unbelievable." I walked away without saying anything. He wasn't the only house guest that summer. In fact, there was never only one guest at Monk's house. Especially in summertime, when my parents' teaching duties died down and they could focus on what they truly loved, drinking and adultery. I don't say that in order to make some sort of tragedy of my childhood. I say it because it's the truth. And that summer, the summer of Chet, there was a rotating cast of hangers-on, graduate students, ex-lovers, and current lovers, all coming and going like moths to a flickering porch light. And these were just the house guests. My parents, as always, had endless parties. I would listen to these parties hum and roar through the walls of my bedroom as I lay in bed. They were familiar symphonies, beginning with bursts of laughter, discordant jazz, and the slap of screen doors, and ending in the early morning hours with the sound of yelling, sometimes sobbing, and always the slam of bedroom doors. Chet was a slightly different breed of animal from the usual houseguest. My mother referred to him as an outsider artist, meaning, I suppose, that he was not affiliated with her college, neither a student nor a visiting artist. I remember my father calling him the homeless degenerate your mother has housed for the summer. Avoid him, Lily. I think he has leprosy, and God knows what's in the beard. I don't think it was genuine advice from my father. My mother was in earshot, and he was speaking for her benefit. But it turned out to be prophetic. I'd spent my entire life at Monk's House, my father's name for the sprawling, rotting, 100-year-old Victorian mansion, an hour from New York City, in the deep woods of Connecticut. David Kintner, my father, was an English novelist who'd made most of his money off the film adaptation of his first and most successful book, a boarding school sex farce that caused a brief sensation in the late 1960s. He'd come to America as a visiting writer at Sheppard University and stayed on as an adjunct when he met Sharon Henderson, my mother, an abstract expressionist with a tenured teaching position in the school's art department. Together, they bought Monk's. It didn't have a name when they purchased it, the year I was conceived, but my father, who rationalized the 6 bedrooms by plans to fill it with creative and intelligent and young and female houseguests, thought he'd like to name it after the house that Virginia and Leonard Wolfe shared. It was also a reference to Thelonious Monk, my father's favorite musician. There were many peculiarities to Monk's, including some unused solar panels that were smothered in ivy, a screening room with an old film projector, a wine cellar with a dirt floor, and a small kidney-shaped swimming pool in the backyard that was rarely cleaned. Over the years, it had devolved back into a murky pond, its bottom and sides covered in algae, its surface constantly filmed in rotting leaves, its unused filter clogged with the bloated corpses of mice and squirrels. At the beginning of that particular summer, I had made an attempt to clean the half-filled pool myself, pulling off the mold-blackened tarp, finding a butterfly net that worked for skimming the leaves, then filling the pool from the hose over the course of one tepid June day. I asked my parents separately if they would pick up pool chemicals the next time they went shopping. My mother's response? I don't want my darling daughter swimming around in a bunch of chemicals all summer. My father promised to make a special trip to the store, but I watched the memory of the promise fade out of his eyes before we even finished the conversation. I swam in the pool anyway, for the first half of the summer, telling myself that at least I had it to myself. The water turned green, and the bottom and sides became slippery with dark algae. I pretended the pool was really a pond, deep in the woods, in a special place that only I knew about, and my friends were the turtles and the fish and the dragonflies. I swam at dusk when the cricket whine was at its highest, nearly blocking out the sounds of parties starting up on the screened porch at the front of the house. It was on one of those dusk swims that I first noticed Chet, a beer bottle in his hand, watching me from the edge of the woods. "How's the water?" he asked when he realized he'd been spotted. "It's all right," I said.
"I didn't even know this pool was back here."
He stepped out of the woods and into the remaining light of the day. He wore a pair of white overalls that were spattered in paint. He sipped at his beer, foam clinging to his beard. "No one uses it but me. My parents don't like to swim." I paddled in the deep end, glad that the water was green and cloudy so that he couldn't see me in my bathing suit.
"Maybe I'll go swimming sometime. Would that be all right with you?"
"I don't care. You can do what you want." He finished his beer in one long pull, making a popping sound when he pulled it away from his lips.
Man, what I really want is to paint this pool. And maybe you'd let me paint you in it. Would you let me do that?
I don't know, I said. What do you mean? He laughed.
Just like this, you and the pool in this light, I would like to create a painting. I mostly do abstracts, but for this...
He trailed off, scratching at the inside of his thigh. After a pause, he asked,
Do you know how goddamn beautiful you are?
No.
You are. You're a beautiful girl. I'm not supposed to say that to you because you're young, but I'm a painter, so it's okay. I understand beauty, or at least I pretend to.
He laughed.
You'll think about it?
I don't know how much more swimming I'll do. The water is kind of dirty.
Okay.
He looked into the woods behind me, slowly bobbing his head.
I need another beer. Can I get you something?
He was now holding the empty bottle upside down by his side, drips of beer falling onto the unmown grass.
I'll get you a beer if you want one.
I don't drink beer. I'm only 13.
Okay,
he said, and stood watching me for a while, waiting to see if I would get out of the water. His mouth hung open slightly, and he scratched again at the inside of his thigh. I stayed put, treading water, and spun so that I wasn't facing him.
Ophelia,
he said, almost to himself. Then,
okay, another beer.
When he left, I got out of the pool, knowing that I was done swimming for the summer, and hating Chet for wrecking my secret pond. I wrapped myself in the large beach towel I'd brought to the pool and ran through the house toward the bathroom nearest my room on the second floor. My chest hurt, as though the anger inside of me was a balloon, slowly inflating, but never going to pop. In the bathroom, with the rattling vent turned on and the shower going, I screamed repeatedly, using the nastiest words I knew. I was screaming because I was mad. But I was also screaming to keep myself from crying. It didn't work. I sat on the tiled floor and cried until my throat hurt. I was thinking of Chet, the scary way he looked at me. But I was also thinking of my parents. Why did they fill our home with strangers? Why did they only know sex maniacs? After showering, I went into my bedroom and looked at myself naked in the full-length mirror on the inside of my closet door. I'd known about sex for almost my entire life. One of my earliest memories was of my parents doing it on a large towel in the dunes on some beach vacation. I was 3 feet away, digging in the sand with a plastic trowel. I remember that my baby bottle was filled with warm apple juice. I turned and looked at my body from all sides, disgusted by the patch of red hair sprouting between my legs. At least my breasts were barely noticeable, unlike my friend Gina, who lived down the road. I pulled my shoulders back, and my breasts completely flattened out. If I held a hand between my legs, I looked the same as I had when I was 10 years old. Skinny, with red hair and freckles that darkened my arms and the base of my neck. I dressed in jeans and a sweatshirt, even though the night was still sweltering hot, and went downstairs to make myself a peanut butter sandwich. I stopped swimming in the pool. I don't know if Chet continued to look for me there. I would see him sometimes on the top step that led to the apartment above my mother's studio, smoking a cigarette and gazing toward the house. And he was occasionally in our kitchen, speaking with my mother, usually about art. His eyes would find me, then slide away, then find me again. My father took off that summer for about 3 weeks. It happened immediately after a visit from several of his English friends, including a young poet named Rose. He introduced us by saying, "Rose, meet Lily. Lily, meet Rose. Do not compete. You are both beautiful flowers." Rose, skinny and with large breasts, smelled of clove cigarettes, and when she shook my hand, she stared at the top of my head. I was worried that after my father disappeared, Chet would show up in the house more often. Instead, another man showed up, with a Russian name. I liked him, but only because he had a beautiful short-haired mutt named Gorky. We hadn't had any animals at the house since Bess, my cat, had died 3 months earlier. With the Russian around, Chet disappeared from view for a while, and I was beginning to feel safe. Then, Chet came to my bedroom late on a Saturday night. I knew it was a Saturday because it was the night of the important party, one that my mother had been talking about for over a week. "Lily, darling, take a bath on Saturday because of the party. Lily, you'll help your mother make the spanakopita for our party, won't you? I'll let you hand them out the way you like." It was strange that she cared about this particular night. She had parties all the time, but usually with teachers and students from the college. For this party, people were coming from New York to meet the Russian. My father was still gone, and my mother was nervous, her short hair sticking out at the back because of how often she ran her fingers through it. I stayed away from the house for most of that Saturday, walking through the stretch of pine trees to my favorite place, a meadow edged with stone walls that abutted a long abandoned farmhouse. I threw rocks at trees until my arm began to ache, then lay back for a while on the soft hummock of grass near the willow. I daydreamed of my other family, the imaginary one with boring parents, and 7 siblings, 4 boys and 3 girls. The day was hot. I could taste salty sweat on my upper lip, and as I lay there, I watched dark, swollen clouds build in the sky. When I heard the first low rumble of thunder, I stood, brushed grass from the back of my legs, and returned to the house. The thunderstorm pelted monks for a dark hour. My mother drank gin and pulled things from the oven, telling the Russian how perfect the storm was, how she couldn't ask for a better soundtrack to her party, although I could tell she was upset. When guests began to arrive, the skies were blue again, the only evidence of the storm, the cleanness of the air, and the steady dripping from the swollen gutters. I passed appetizers to people I'd never seen before, then snuck away to my room, bringing 2 cold Pop-Tarts with me for my dinner. I ate in my room and tried to read. I had taken a paperback from my mother's stack of books by her side of the bed. It was called Damage by Josephine Hart, and I'd heard her talking about how she didn't like it, how it was just trash dressed up as something literary. It made me want to read it, but I didn't really like it either. It was about an Englishman, like my father, who was having sex with his son's girlfriend. I hated everyone in it. I gave up and pulled a Nancy Drew from my shelf. Number 10, The Password to Larkspur Lane. I knew I was too old to be reading Nancy Drew, but it was by far my favorite. I fell asleep while reading it. I woke to the sound of my bedroom door being opened. Light fell in from the hallway, and I could hear loud rock music coming from downstairs. I was curled on my side, a single sheet pulled up to my waist, facing the door. I cracked open my eyes and could see Chet standing in the doorframe. The light was coming from behind him, but he was easy to identify because of the beard and the dark-framed glasses, an edge of which had caught the yellow light from the hall. He swayed a little, like a tree in a strong wind.
I didn't move, in the hopes that he would go away. Maybe I wasn't who he was looking for, even though I knew I was. I considered screaming or trying to run from the room, but there was a steady thump of bass and drum throughout the house, and I didn't think anyone would hear me. And then Chet would kill me for sure. So I closed my eyes, hoping he would go away. And with my eyes closed, I heard him step into the room, quietly shut the door behind him. I decided to keep my eyes shut, pretend I was asleep. My heart beat in my chest like a jumping bean, but I kept my breathing regular, in through my nose and out through my mouth. I listened as Chet took a few steps forward. I knew he was standing right over me. I could hear his own breath, ragged and wet, and I could smell him. The fruity, musty smell, mixed with the smell of cigarettes and alcohol. "Lily," he said in a loud whisper. I didn't move. He leaned in closer, said my name again, a little quieter this time. I pretended I was in a deep sleep and couldn't hear a thing. I pulled my knees up a little tighter to my body, moving the way I thought a sleeping person would move. I knew what he was doing in my room, and I knew what he wanted. He was going to have sex with me. But as far as I knew, that was only something he could do if I was awake. So I planned on staying asleep, no matter what he did. I heard the creak of his knees and the rustle of his jeans, then smelled the sour, beery smell of his breath. He had crouched down beside me. The song from downstairs, its thumping bass, stopped. And another song, that sounded the same, started up again. I heard the sound of a zipper being slowly unzipped, one tiny, metallic pluck at a time. Then a rhythmic sound, like a hand being rubbed rapidly back and forth across a sweater. He was doing it to himself, and not to me. My plan was working. The sound got faster and louder, and he said my name a few more times in low, hoarse whispers. I thought he wasn't going to touch me, but I felt the air shift a little in front of my chest. Then felt a finger graze along the pajama fabric that stretched across my breasts. It was warm in the room, but cold prickles coursed all over my skin. I willed myself to keep my eyes closed. Chet pressed his fingers against my chest, his sharp nails pinching, then made a sound that was halfway between a grunt and an intake of breath. And he pulled his hand away from my nipple. I listened as he zipped his pants back up and quickly backed out of the room. He thudded into the door frame on the way out, then pulled the door closed behind him, not even trying to keep quiet. I stayed in my curled-up position for another minute, then got off the bed, took my desk chair, and tried to jam it up under the doorknob of my door. It was something Nancy Drew would do. The chair didn't quite fit. It was a little too short, but it was better than nothing. If Chet came back, it would be hard for him to open the door at least, and the chair would fall over and make a noise. I didn't think I would sleep that night, but I did, and when morning came, I lay in my bed thinking about what I should do. My worst fear was that if I told my mother about what had happened, she would tell me that I should have sex with Chet, or else she would be mad that I let him come into my room, or that I let him watch me in the pool. I knew that this was something I needed to take care of on my own. And I knew how I would do it.
Chapter 3. Ted. At nearly midnight, I stood on the front steps of the bay-fronted brownstone I owned with Miranda. The taxi's red lights receding down the street, and tried to remember where I'd stowed the house keys when I'd left for London a week earlier. Just as I was unzipping the outside pocket of my carry-on, the front door swung open. Miranda was in mid-yawn. She wore a short nightshirt and a pair of wool socks. "How was London?" she asked, after kissing me on the mouth. Her breath was slightly sour, and I imagined she'd been asleep in front of the television. "Damp? Profitable?" "Yes, damp and profitable." I shut the door behind me and dropped my luggage on the hardwood floor. The house smelled of takeout Thai. "I'm surprised to see you here," I said. "I thought you'd be in Maine."
"I wanted to see you, Teddy. It's been a whole week. Are you drunk?"
The flight was delayed, and I drank a few martinis. "Do I reek?" "Yes. Brush your teeth and come to bed. I'm exhausted." I watched Miranda climb the steep steps to our second-floor bedroom, watched the muscles in her slim calves tense and untense, watched the nightshirt sway back and forth with the movement of her hips, then thought of Brad Daggett bending her over the carpentry table, lifting her skirt. I went downstairs to the basement level, where our kitchen and dining room were located. I found a carton of red curry shrimp in the fridge and ate it cold, sitting at our butcher block island. My head was starting to ache, and I was thirsty. I realized that without having fallen asleep, I was already hungover from all the gin I'd had in the airport lounge, and then on the flight. The redhead from the bar had also been seated in business class, across from me, and one row behind. After boarding the plane, we'd kept talking across the aisle, even though we'd temporarily ceased our discussion of my wife's infidelities. The old woman next to me in the window seat saw us talking and said, "Would you and your wife like to sit next to one another?" "Thank you," I said. "We'd love to." Once she was settled in, and once I'd ordered a gin and tonic from the flight attendant, I asked for her name again. "It's Lily," she said.
"Lily what?"
"I'll tell you, but let's first play a game."
"Okay."
"It's very easy. Since we're on a plane, and it's a long flight, and we're not going to see each other again, let's tell each other the absolute truth about everything."
"You won't even tell me your last name," I said.
She laughed. "True, but that's what lets us play by these rules. If we know one another, then the game doesn't work."
"Give me an example."
"Okay. I hate gin. I ordered a martini because you had one in front of you and it looked sophisticated."
"Really?"
I said.
"No judgment," she said.
"Your turn."
"Okay."
I thought for a moment, then said, "I love gin so much I'm worried sometimes I'm an alcoholic. If I had my way, I'd drink about 6 martinis a night."
"It's a start," she said.
"You might have a drinking problem.
Your wife is cheating on you. How about you? Have you ever cheated on her?"
"No, I haven't. I have, what was it Jimmy Carter said? I've had lust in my heart, of course. I've already imagined having sex with you, for instance."
"You have?"
Her eyebrows raised, and she looked a little shocked.
"The absolute truth, remember?" I said.
"Don't be surprised.
Most men you meet are probably thinking disgusting things about you within 5 minutes."
"Is that really true?"
"Yep."
"How disgusting."
"You really don't want to know."
"Maybe I do," she said, and shifted toward me in her seat. I drank a little of my gin and tonic, the ice knocking against my teeth.
"It's interesting," she said.
"I just can't imagine what it would be like to meet someone and know right away that I want to have sex with them."
"It's not that exactly," I said.
"It's more like an ingrained response where you just picture it. Like when we were standing in line at the boarding gate. I looked at you and pictured you naked. It just happens."
"That never happens to women?
Like suddenly imagining sex with a man?"
"No, not really. With women it's different. What we wonder about is if the man we just met wants to have sex with us."
I laughed. "Well, he does. Just assume it. Trust me, though, you don't want to know more than that."
"See, isn't this game fun? Now, why don't you tell me more about how you want to kill your wife?"
"Ah," I said. I don't know if I was really serious about that.
"You sure?"
"The way you told that story, I couldn't tell." "Well, I'll admit that after seeing them together in our house, I think if I had a gun on me, that I could easily have shot them both through the window."
"So you are thinking of killing her," she said,
the plane starting its pre-takeoff hum. We each buckled in, and I took a longish sip of my gin. I'd always been a nervous flyer.
"Look," she continued, "I'm not trying to trap you into saying something you don't want to say. I'm interested is all. This is just part of the game. Absolute truth."
"Then you go first. All you've told me is that you don't like gin."
"Okay," she said, and thought a moment. Truthfully, I don't think murder is necessarily as bad as people make it out to be. Everyone dies. What difference does it make if a few bad apples get pushed along a little sooner than God intended? And your wife, for example, seems like the kind worth killing. The plane's hum turned into a whine, and the captain told the flight attendants to take their seats. I was grateful for a moment when I didn't need to immediately respond to the woman next to me. Her words had echoed the persistent thoughts I had been plagued with for a week as I entertained fantasies of killing my wife. I'd been telling myself that killing Miranda would do the world a favor, and along came this passenger who was suddenly giving me the moral authority to act on my desires. And while I was shocked by what she had said, I was also in that state of drunkenness, gin buzzing through my body, that makes one wonder why anyone wants to ever be sober. I felt both clear-headed and uninhibited at the same time, and if we'd been anywhere semi-private, I think I would have taken Lily in my arms right then and tried to kiss her. Instead, after the plane took off, I kept talking. I'll admit that the thought of actually killing my wife is appealing to me. There was a prenup, so Miranda doesn't get half of all I have, but she gets a lot, enough to be comfortable for the rest of her life. And there's no clause about infidelity. I could hire a lawyer, get him to hire a detective and make a case, but it would be expensive, and in the end I'd waste time and money, and I'd be humiliated. If she'd come to me and told me about the affair, even told me that she'd fallen in love with Daggett and wanted to leave me, I'd have allowed a divorce. I would have hated her, but I would have moved on. What I can't get past, is the way that she and Brad acted that day I saw them fucking in my house. When I'd spoken to them earlier, they were both so calm and convincing. Miranda lied so easily. I don't know how she learned to be like that. But then I started to think about it, to add up everything I knew about her, the different ways she acts in front of different people, and I realized that this is who she is. A shallow, fake liar. Maybe even a sociopath. I don't know how I didn't see this before. I imagine she acted the way she thought you wanted to see her. How did you meet her? I told her how we'd met, at a housewarming party of a mutual friend in New Essex on a summer night. I'd spotted her right away. Other guests were wearing summer dresses and button-up shirts, but Miranda was in cut-off jeans, so short that the white pockets hung below the tattered edges, in a tank top with a Jasper John's Target stenciled on the front. She was holding a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon, and she was talking with Chad Pavone, my college friend who'd bought the house we were there to celebrate. Miranda's head was thrown back in laughter. I thought two things right away, that she was the sexiest woman I'd ever personally seen, and that Chad Pavone had never uttered a funny line in his life. And what was she laughing at? I quickly looked away from them, surveying the party for someone I might know. Truth was, seeing Miranda had felt like being punched in the chest, a sudden realization that women like her existed outside of dirty magazines and Hollywood movies, and that, in all likelihood, she was here with someone else. I learned her name from Chad's wife. It was Miranda Hobart. She was house-sitting in New Essex for a year. She was some sort of artist, and she'd found a job at the box office of a local summer theater. "She single?" I asked. "Believe it or not, she is. You should talk with her." "I doubt I'm her type." "You won't know if you don't ask." When we did end up talking, it was Miranda who approached me. The party had gone late, and I was sitting by myself on the sloping lawn at the back of Chad and Sherry's house. Through a cluster of roofs, I could make out the purple sheen of the ocean, lit periodically by the rotating beam from a lighthouse. Miranda sat down next to me. "I hear you're very rich," she said, her voice deep and accentless, slightly slurred. "It's what everyone's talking about." I had recently engineered a buyout between a small company that had developed a picture uploading program and a major social media site for a sum that even I considered vaguely ridiculous. "I am," I said. "Just so you know, I'm not going to sleep with you just because you're rich." She was smiling in a challenging way. "Good to know," I said, the words sounding clumsy in my own mouth, the line of roofs in the distance tilting slightly. "But I bet you'd marry me." She threw her head back and laughed throatily. It was the way I'd first seen her, laughing at something Chad had said. But up close, the gesture did not seem as fake. I studied her jawline, imagined how it would feel to press my mouth against the softness of her neck. "Sure I'd marry you," she said. Are you asking?
Why not? I said. So when should we get married?
Next weekend, maybe. I don't think we should rush into something like this.
I agree. It's a serious commitment.
Just out of curiosity, I said. I know what I'm bringing to this relationship, but what exactly do you bring? Can you cook?
Can't cook, can't sew.
I can dust.
You sure you want to marry me?
I'd be honored.
We talked some more, and then we kissed. Right there on the lawn.
Awkwardly. Our teeth clicking, our chins bumping. She laughed out loud again, and I told her the wedding was off. But it wasn't off. We did get married. Not a week later, but a year.
Do you think she was playing me from the beginning? I asked Lily.
The plane had taken off, and we were in that peculiar bubble known as air travel, between countries, speeding at a terrifying velocity at ice-cold heights, yet lulled by fake air and soft seats and the steady purr of engineering.
Probably.
But the way she approached me, the way she brought up how rich I was right from the beginning, it seemed like a joke to her, like something she would never say if she were trying to land a husband.
Reverse psychology. Bring it up right away, and she looks innocent somehow.
I was silent, thinking about it.
Hey, she continued, just because she used you doesn't mean that she doesn't have feelings for you, that you don't have a good time together.
We did have a good time together, and now she's having a good time with someone else.
What does she get out of Brad, do you think?
What do you mean?
I asked. What's the angle?
She's risking the marriage. Even if she gets half, she probably won't get her dream beach house that she's building. Being with Brad could wreck it for her.
I've thought a lot about this. At first I thought she was in love with him, but now I don't think she really loves anyone. I think she's bored. She's obviously done with me, except as a source of income. She's not going to change, and she's still young and beautiful enough to hurt countless people. Maybe I really should kill her, just to remove her from the world.
I turned toward my neighbor, but didn't look her in the eye. Her arms were folded on her lap, and I saw goosebumps spread along the exposed skin of her arms. Was the airplane making her cold, or was it me?
You would be doing the world a favor, she said, her voice quiet enough that I had to lean toward her a little as I raised my eyes. I honestly believe that. Like I said before, everyone is going to die eventually. If you killed your wife, you would only be doing to her what would happen anyway, and you'd save other people from her. She's a negative. She makes the world worse. And what she's done to you is worse than death. Everyone dies, but not everyone has to see someone they love with another person. She struck the first blow. In the circle of yellow from the reading light, I could see flecks of many different colors in the pale green of her eyes. She blinked, her papery eyelids mottled with pink. The closeness of our faces felt more intimate than sex, and I was surprised by our sudden eye contact, as I would have been had I suddenly discovered her hand on my pants.
How would I do it? I asked, and felt goosebumps break out along my own limbs.
In such a way that you don't get caught.
I laughed, and the temporary spell was broken.
That easy?
That easy.
Another drink, sir?
The flight attendant, a towering, slim-hipped brunette with bright pink rouge, was holding a hand toward my empty glass. I wanted one, but turning my head toward the attendant had caused a sudden rush of dizziness, and I declined, asking for a water instead. When I turned back, my neighbor was yawning, her arms outstretched, finger pads touching the back of the soft seat in front of her.
You're tired, I said.
A little. Let's keep talking, though. This is the most interesting conversation I've had on a plane.
A prickle of doubt passed through me.
Was I just an interesting conversation? I could hear her talking to a friend the next day.
You're not going to believe this guy I met at the airport. Frick told me all about how he planned on killing his wife.
As though reading my thoughts, she touched my arm with her hand.
Sorry, she said. That sounded flip.
I'm taking this seriously. Or as seriously as you'd like me to take it. We're playing a game of truth, remember? And truthfully, I don't have a moral problem with you killing your wife. She misrepresented herself to you. She used you. Married you. She took the money you earned. And now she's cheating on you with a man who is also taking your money. She deserves whatever she gets as far as I'm concerned.
Jesus, you're not kidding.
I'm not. But I'm just someone you don't know sitting next to you on a plane. You need to decide for yourself. There's a big difference between wanting to kill your wife and actually doing it. And there's an even bigger difference between killing someone and getting away with it.
Are you speaking from experience? I play the fifth on that one, she said, yawning again. I think I'm actually going to take a little nap, if you don't mind. You keep thinking.